And welcome everybody to Studio 2. Hello, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Some big news this morning from the highest court in the country, Avi. You know, it's the end of June.
Yes.
That time of the year. David Cohen, law professor at Drexel, joins us to talk about the latest Supreme Court decisions that were just released this morning. We're talking about affirmative action, religious freedoms, and voting rights. And we want to hear from you. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. We want your reactions.
Yes, and in case you forgot, it is Thursday, which means Trivia Thursday here at Studio 2. That's the end of the show. We're going to hand out some swag, hopefully, if our contestant gets it right today. But before we get all into that, Cherry, we're going to start with some headlines. And I think we'll start in a pretty obvious place, which is the quality of the air outside. Not great right now. I'm pulling up the latest AQI reading from Air Now. 183 here in Philadelphia, which is in the red, unhealthy zone. As I'm sure all of you know at this point, this is because of smoke from Canadian wildfires. Here in Philly, city pools closed today. Summer camps run by the city moved indoors. The city recommends canceling outdoor events, staying inside, wearing a KN95 mask. And there are places to get one, by the way, from the health department if you look online on the city's website. We do expect this to linger into tomorrow. It's not going to get much better today, according to forecasts. These things, however, are notoriously hard to predict, but they hope by end of day Friday, early Saturday, this will clear out in part because of some rain expected.
Yeah, it feels like Groundhog Day to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like not too many days ago. Earlier this month, we had, you know, a maroon alert. And
yes.
I'm just like, I'm learning all the different color codes for air quality.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Another red alert. I was driving into work today and I started coughing. Just, you know, and I was like, I need to get the air filter in my car changed. So I called the company right away because, you know, you have to change those air filters in your car and in your homes because of the quality of the air. And I'm sure we'll have to do that more often now that we're dealing with this
new reality
issue. Yeah.
I do want to delineate for folks because you mentioned maroon. This is not quite as severe as it was earlier in the month where we were in that maroon category, which is actually another category above red. There's red, purple, and maroon. The maroon was unprecedented since they've been measuring this stuff.
And it was hard to even walk outside
with
the maroon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Red does happen from time to time, even in quote-unquote normal times. But it is still bad. It is still unhealthy, and we want folks to stay safe.
Yeah. And moving on, we're going to be talking about now mail-in ballots.
Yes.
An analysis of mail ballots in Philly found that non-white and lower-income voters' ballots were more likely to be rejected than and this is analysis by the Philadelphia Inquirer as well as Spotlight PA. Apparently 5%, that's 4,300 of mail ballots, were tossed out from the May primary. The top reasons: the ballot was undated or had an incorrect date, it arrived too late, or it was considered to be a naked ballot. That's a ballot that doesn't have the inner secrecy envelope and or just the outer envelope. Now, the Pennsylvania law requires that mail-in ballots be signed and that they be correctly dated. And what was interesting and concerning to me is the disparity here, because the largest percentage of male voters in the city are white and high income, but there's a disproportionate number of rejected ballots from Black and Latino voters who are also lower income.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is probably going to force, I think, you know, folks may say Black and Latino voters may be more likely to say, hey, I need to go in person because I'm a little nervous about my ballot being rejected. And when you look at these numbers, it's just you don't want voters to be disenfranchised at all. So I think there probably needs to be some voter education here, but we'll see.
Yeah. One of the questions I have is how much of this is now just sort of baked in and permanent, because when we're talking about the conversation on voting access and mail voting during the pandemic, things were in flux. So the number of people doing it was way up and down. The number of rejected ballots was sort of, it was all new data. We didn't know what to make of it. Now things seem to be settling and solidifying and calcifying a bit. And so it's possible moving forward that this is just sort of, this is what it is. You know, about 5% of mail ballots are going to get tossed, and people who proportionately vote by mail are going to, you know, have a, just a certain number of votes thrown out every single election. So we'll see if these numbers move much going forward. I am wondering, though, if this is where this is sort of the settling point.
Yeah. And I've done mail-in ballots. You really do have to pay attention and just make sure you put every, you follow all the directions, because you do not want your ballot to be thrown out. And if you are worried about that, just go vote day of and do a provisional ballot just to make sure.
You also have to pay attention if you want to do well on Jeopardy. You like that?
Good transition.
Thank you. That just came to me. So we were talking about game shows yesterday, and we wanted to note that earlier this week on Jeopardy, there was a New Jersey-themed category on the show. I am curious how folks would have done who are in our listening audience.
And please use your game show host voice. Please.
I've retired that. That's from yesterday. You only got to hear that yesterday. If you missed it, you have to listen to the Studio 2 podcast, folks. It was interesting. They talked about Jersey Boys, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. That was one of the answers. Saltwater, Taffy, Johnson & Johnson, which is based in New Brunswick. Also, Princeton University made the cut, as well as Trenton, the state capital. So, you know, if you know your Jersey stuff, I think you would have cruised.
Yeah, pretty decent. I probably would have got hung up on the Saltwater Taffy one, maybe the Johnson & Johnson. I'm still learning Jersey history.
You're a Delawarean.
I am at this point, yes. Well, but early. It hasn't even been a year yet. But it's but yeah, it's very interesting. And it's nice to have Jersey represented on Jeopardy.
Absolutely.
And so, beginning today, you probably heard about this. We're going to move on to our newsmaker segment. Probably heard about this. Beginning today, Moms for Liberty is holding its summit in Philadelphia. There's a reception at the Museum of the American Revolution. And later on, there will be special guests, including former President Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. It caused a bit of conflict and controversy here in Philly. And Maddie Hanna is our guest today. She is the K-12 education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has been covering this. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Maddie, we have to start with the basics. Who are Moms for Liberty? Because 2-3 years ago, no one had even heard of this group, because I don't even think they existed, right?
They didn't. That's right. It's grown really fast. They are a group founded in 2021. They call themselves a parental rights group. They were really born out of opposition to pandemic safety measures, and they've since really shifted to focusing on what is happening in schools, in classrooms. They have largely sought to limit discussion of topics like race, gender, and sexuality, saying these are not in the purview of public schools to be dealing with, essentially.
Yeah, and so how have they attracted so much attention and controversy?
Well, they were founded in Florida, and the leaders do have ties to some prominent Republicans there. One of the original directors of the group is married to the chairman of the Republican Party. They, in that state, they got a lot of attention from conservative media early on. And I do think this message of, parental rights has resonated with a number of people. There were the Virginia governor, Glenn Youngkin, for instance. There was a lot of attention to his winning election there and how his message of parental rights may or may not have contributed to that. So they've certainly been tied in with the Republican political movement for some time.
And building on that, it does seem like they have captured the attention of the Republican political establishment quite quickly. We mentioned Trump, DeSantis, others are going to be here this weekend as well. Can you give us a sense of the roster of folks and really what that says about their place in the modern conservative movement?
Yeah, I think there are a number of these sort of, again, self-described parental rights groups that have kind of gained steam in the past few years, but they're really, they might be the most prominent voice. We've got DeSantis coming tomorrow morning. Nikki Haley, the former South Carolina governor, who's also seeking the Republican nomination, is speaking around lunchtime. You've got Trump tomorrow evening. Vivek Ramaswamy is appearing on Saturday. So it's really they've become a potent force that these politicians are seeking to attract and have the support of as they're vying for the nomination.
Now, I got to ask about the Southern Poverty Law Center has designated this organization a hate group. Can you talk about that a little bit? What went into that decision and what has been the reaction?
So they've designated them, yes, an anti-government extremist group, really looking at kind of their overall messaging, which they say is kind of targeting the institution of public education, saying that what Moms for Liberty is seeking to do is really undermine public schooling, spreading this message that you've got government schools and government educators that are trying to indoctrinate kids, and saying that this is a dangerous message. So they added them this month to their listing, and Moms for Liberty has largely been dismissive of this, saying that the Southern Poverty Law Center is disregarding that parents just want a voice in their children's education and spreading hate towards its members. But certainly that designation has gotten a lot of attention from people.
And I just want to clarify, it's not a hate designation. It's an
anti-government extremist. Yeah. I mean, the Law Center kind of has this collection of hate groups and anti-government extremist groups. So they list them kind of all together. But yes, they designated them as an anti-government group.
And this group has been active in local districts as well. And one of my understandings is one of the main critiques of what they do is that, well, I guess the critics would say that what they say they are in favor of parental rights, but what they target is sort of very clearly meant to squash certain types of opinions from being expressed. Can you go into more detail there?
Yeah, I think, critics would say it's whose parental rights, and other parents would say, I want my child to have the right to go into the school library and read these books that Moms for Liberty members may be arguing against because they say they're sexually explicit, but they're books that have been targeted, for instance, have often been about LGBTQ characters or stories or people of color. And so the sort of there's a disconnect, I guess, in terms of when they're arguing for parental rights, who they're arguing on behalf of, and kind of what that phrase means in terms of who should get to dictate what is or isn't taught in schools.
And as we get ready to wrap up, just got to ask you, there has been local opposition. What do you expect as all these folks, flock to Philly, and what do you expect to see?
Well, we're expecting protests beginning today, both outside the Marriott and outside later this evening at the Museum of American Revolution. Protests continuing tomorrow morning, again, outside the Marriott. There's been a lot of groups, both local and national. So we'll see exactly what develops.
Absolutely. We'll all be tracking it. Maddie Hanna, more closely than most. Maddie Hanna works for The Inquirer as a K-12 education reporter. Maddie, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we're talking about the latest from the Supreme Court, and there is a lot to discuss.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. What is my name? Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Yes.
Gosh, it's been a day, and it was a big morning in D.C. The Supreme Court handed down three decisions, two that were much anticipated. The court ruled on affirmative action, ruling that race-conscious college admissions are unconstitutional, or at least that seems to be the big takeaway right now.
Yeah, and it was a 6-3 decision with the more liberal justices dissenting. Now, this ruling could have a profound impact on the diverse makeup of colleges and universities, who will now have to shift the way they consider applicant backgrounds. And in another big ruling, the court decided unanimously on the religious freedom case about a Lancaster postal worker who refused to work on Sundays. And there are more decisions to come about LGBTQ plus discrimination and President Biden's executive action for giving student loans. A lot of people looking forward to that, all while the court is facing major scrutiny.
So we've asked someone who can apply a little scrutiny to all of this to come and join us and break it all down. Next to me is Drexel University law professor David Cohen. David's going to talk about the cases, the implications for all of this. And mind you, it's all still evolving. None of us have had a chance to read through everything in the opinions that came down today. But we do want to hear from you. Listeners, do you have questions about race-conscious admissions in higher education? What do you think about the opinions handed down so far in the big high-stakes cases? Email us, studio2@whyy.org. And David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me this afternoon.
So we're going to dig right in. David, the U.S. Supreme Court, they held that use of race in any capacity in college admissions is now unconstitutional. Explain what this means. Well, first, react to it, and then kind of explain what this ruling means.
Well, I'm not at all surprised about this. The U.S. Supreme Court has been pushing in this direction for a long time, and Chief Justice Roberts in particular, it seems like he was almost put on the court in order to end affirmative action. It's been one of his life missions, and he wrote the opinion here today saying that the way Harvard and the University of North Carolina use race in admissions is unconstitutional and violates other federal laws as well. I think a lot is left to be determined what universities are going to do in response to this, because as much as what Harvard and University of North Carolina did was illegal, unlawful, the court said that students can talk about how race impacts their own life in their essays, and schools can take that into account. A lot of lack of clarity in terms of what that's going to mean, but there is sort of an out. But overall, what the court is saying is that you can't take race into consideration in school admissions. And I think that this is really a blow to affirmative action and diversity on campus.
We should note, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, public university, Harvard, private university, cases combined here. So this applies to universities, public and private, right?
Yeah, the University of North Carolina is bound by the Constitution because it's a public school, just like all public schools are. Private schools that receive federal money are bound by Title VI, which is part of the Civil Rights Acts of 1964. So there are some private schools out there that don't get any federal dollars, but that's a really small number. Those are the only ones that don't have to follow this decision.
Now, Justice Sonia Sotomayor dissented, saying that the Supreme Court is, quote, entrenching social inequity into education and that it's cementing a superficial rule of colorblindness. You touched upon this. Their universities will probably have some more legal ways. How do you see them navigating this and finding an out that won't get them in trouble before the court?
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to see. I mean, we have seen some states ban affirmative action in their state law, and we've seen a drop in diversity on those campuses. So I think that, you know, decisions like this, bans like this have real effects. But what the court did here was say that a student talking about their life can talk about how race or ethnicity has impacted their individual life. And if it shows that you can overcome obstacles and barriers and you have perseverance, then schools can take that into consideration about that individual. So you can't look generally and say we want a diverse student body, but they can say this individual showing that they overcome racism or some other problem in their life, that we can look at that more favorably in the application process. So I think there's going to be battles in courts to come about what schools do. And university lawyers and applicants are going to be trying to figure out what this little sort of window of opportunity means going forward.
Yeah, I was going to ask if this is the final word, and I hear you saying it's not the final word, at least in terms of its applicability to college admissions specifically.
Yeah, and it's also important to note the court sort of dropped a footnote saying this doesn't apply to the military. That might be a different question. So can the military and military schools have affirmative action? That could be a different question. Mm. This doesn't apply to employment. It doesn't apply to other types of affirmative action, like for athletes and legacy and people whose parents work at universities. Universities have all sorts of affirmative action that are not based on race, and they can continue to privilege legacies and athletes.
Mm. Can I ask a follow-up on that? Because so why doesn't it apply to those other types of affirmative action? It seems, from my understanding, my layperson's understanding, this is all about the 14th Amendment. So can you describe what is the 14th Amendment and why is it being interpreted in this case to only apply to race-conscious admissions?
I mean, it's because the 14th Amendment was put into this Constitution after the Civil War in order to remedy the race discrimination and slavery and the effects of slavery that came afterwards. So it was really about race. So that's why legacy admissions and athletics admissions are not at issue because of this case, even though they do overwhelmingly benefit white students because they are not intended to, or maybe they are intended to, but on their face, they're not written to benefit
white
students.
The way it's written doesn't say admit.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So because race-based affirmative action is explicitly about race, the court says, the court basically says we need to have a colorblind constitution. And this has been contested almost from day one with the 14th Amendment. Is it about being colorblind, saying we can't ever consider race? Or is it about remedying the effects of the horrors of this country's past with respect to our racial legacy? And the dissenters, Justice Sotomayor, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. along with Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson, say the 14th Amendment is about remedying the racial discrimination in our past, and you have to take race into consideration in order to do that. The majority, the six conservatives on the court, said, no, you can't take race into account. We're done with racism. Our country's beyond that. So everything has to be race neutral. It's a very cramped view, in my view, of what the goal of the 14th Amendment is.
And I have to ask you this. I mean, I want to talk about public sentiment a little bit, because a Pew Research poll showed that only a third of Americans actually approve of affirmative action or the consideration of race in college admissions, half disapproved. Although when you look at it by race, about half of Black people do approve and about 40% of Hispanics approve. Makeup of the court aside, do you think this ruling was sort of headed in the direction of the majority of Americans' public opinion?
Yeah, I've seen similar polls as you, and it does seem like the court here is moving in the direction or deciding a case that is parallel to what public opinion is. But, you know, this is one of those areas where public opinion, the whole point of a constitutional protection around race discrimination is that public opinion shouldn't decide the outcome of our protections involving race, because it's about protecting the minority, numerical minority, from the majority. So if all we care about is public opinion, then you're almost always going to disadvantage the numerical minority. And that's the opposite of what the 14th Amendment is about.
And I have a quick follow-up to that question, because 6-3, a long, you know, political ideological lines here. What do you think that says, especially to minority groups who basically use the court as a safe haven?
Yeah, I mean, this is just another decision. Not every decision from the Supreme Court is split clearly along ideological lines, but this is one of them, and many of the high-profile cases are. This is six justices appointed by Republican presidents adopting the Republican Party line, and it's clear that the party line from that political party is that we should have no more affirmative action and that we're done with racism in this country, so we don't need race consideration.
We are talking with David Cohen, who is a professor at Drexel University, a Drexel law professor, talking all about the Supreme Court and particularly what they did this morning in terms of overturning decades of precedent around race-conscious college admissions. We are taking your emails as well, studio2@whyy.org, bringing in an email from Anka. The decision on affirmative action shows that justice is blind to persistent and systemic racism in the U.S. And David, I believe this goes back to what you were saying about conflicting interpretations of the 14th Amendment. So moving forward, what does this mean the court might do in other instances that might involve interpretation of the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, the court is letting us know that the 14th Amendment is, as the Chief Justice says in this opinion, it's about getting rid of all race discrimination. And anything involving race, to him, is race discrimination. So he wants, and the justices who support him, want the 14th Amendment to basically say race is not an issue that can ever be used in American life. And as the email suggests, what that does is it does turn a blind eye to the fact that the reality for many people's lives is that race does matter in how they are treated, how they experience the world, and that the government now it's very hard for the government to try to make up for that.
So what other areas of life might this meander into, or do we just not know yet? I mean, if that is what the court is saying, what the 14th Amendment means, are there other places they could go to apply that?
Yeah, I mean, so issues around employment, affirmative action and employment, that's a different statute. That's not generally the Constitution. That's Title VII, another civil rights act. So issues around affirmative action and employment, in contracting and government benefits. I think the court has been pushing in this direction for a long time. And it just shows here that they are just getting bolder in doing so. And as long as the court composition remains what it is now, this is how the court is going to look at race.
Very interesting and a little scary at the same time. And I want to sort of kind of pivot to another big case that came out today that kind of goes into the issue of employment, because you just mentioned employment there. This was a big win for religious groups, and it's related to employer accommodations for workers. Could you explain what that decision was today and why it's so significant?
Yeah, this is a case. It's called Groff versus DeJoy, and it involves a postal worker who said because of his religion, he couldn't work on Sundays. And the post office needed him to work on Sundays because, you know, as we know, a lot of packages get delivered on Sundays now. And so the postal office did not want to accommodate his request not to work on Sundays because they said it would burden the other people who work there because now they would have to work on Sundays. And this was a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court saying that they didn't rule in his favor. Ultimately, they basically said that the lower courts need to apply a test that shows that the government, the employer, has to really be burdened. It can't just be a little bit of burden. They have to show a substantial burden before they can fire someone for asking for a religious accommodation. So it puts a thumb on the scale of the religious employee in asking for an accommodation. Again, it doesn't decide the ultimate outcome in this particular case, but the court is saying that it's a really high bar for an employer to say, we can't accommodate you.
And it seemed like some religious freedom advocates were hoping for a complete overturn of a 1977 decision. I think I have the name of the ruling. Hardison, I believe, is the name of the case. It didn't quite go that far. I know you're still poring through the details, but your impression is it did not go that far.
No, it didn't go that far. It just said that when we have said in the past an undue hardship and a substantial burden, we really mean it. It has to be a really substantial burden. It can't just be it's going to be require a little bit of scheduling changes. It has to be a real substantial burden. So that's going to be harder for employers to do what they did here, which is fire the employer, try to, because he couldn't work Sundays.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure that we're clear. This applies to federal employers, or does this apply more broadly?
It applies to any employer covered by Title VII, so you have to have more than 50 employees, but that's most, you know, a lot of employers.
A lot of larger employers, yeah. So they have to
15. I said 50. I meant 15. So it's almost all employees, okay. Employers.
Yeah, and another big case that out of Colorado involves a cake designer, also related to religious freedom, who refused to create a cake for a same-sex couple. Lay out the arguments there, and I know that ruling has not yet come down.
Yeah, that's going to come, I think, tomorrow. You know, if there's one basic principle of this Supreme Court, it's that a conservative religious objector will win. So I'm sure this person's going to win, which is that this is someone who designs websites. And under Colorado law, you're not allowed to discriminate based on sexual orientation. But this website designer said, I don't want to design a website for a same-sex couple who wants to get married. And because she objects to same-sex weddings, same-sex marriage. And so the Supreme Court's going to consider whether she has a First Amendment right to not designed this website. And, you know, it's a clash between anti-discrimination principles and religious freedom. And in this court in the past has shown that when there's a clash that involves religious freedom wins, at least for conservative Christians.
Right, because there had been a cake-based case in the past in which they had sided with the baker. Now it's a web designer, but also wedding-based. And it's because, I'm guessing, right, it's because of same-sex marriage, specific objection to same-sex marriage on religious principle.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a case out of Philadelphia a couple years ago with adoption agencies that had to follow the Philadelphia requirements around non-discrimination on sexual orientation, and the court ruled again for the religious objector.
There was a case in which the most strident conservative activist did not come out on top. And this is a case related to the independent legislature theory surrounding elections. So first, can you lay out briefly that theory and what the court did in this case?
Yeah, I mean, this is a theory that really sort of forms the backdrop of the attempts to overturn the 2020 election, which is that the Constitution requires state legislatures to set the rules for federal elections. So when we elect our members of Congress here in Pennsylvania, it is the Pennsylvania legislature that sets the districts and the time and how the election happens. But the Pennsylvania Supreme Court can and has reviewed those maps to make sure that they are consistent with state constitutional law. This theory was that the courts have to stay out. The state courts have to stay out. That when state legislatures act, no one reviews that. And so the U.S. Supreme Court rejected that theory. And I think this was a really important win for democracy, because if they hadn't rejected that theory, you could have a situation where very partisan state legislatures just draw the maps however they want to benefit their party, and the state Supreme Court can't review that. Or the greater fear, if a state votes for someone for president, the legislators can send their own slate without the governor being involved, without the governor and without the state Supreme Court involved. So this really prevents runaway legislatures from taking over federal elections.
Yeah, and I got to ask you about another big case that will likely come tomorrow on student loans. Explain that case. I know millions of Americans are biting their nails to see what the outcome of that will be.
Yeah, this is about President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan up to $20,000. And it was challenged by two people who didn't get this benefit, and then also by six very conservative states. And we have to wait till tomorrow to see what happens in this case. They are saying that President Biden overstepped his authority, that he doesn't have the authority to do this on his own. But wrapped up in this case is also whether these particular challengers are connected enough to the loan program to sue.
Do they have standing? More
right.
Or less?
So in legal terms, we call this standing, because not anyone can just go into court and say, I don't like a policy.
Right.
And so the court may decide this case on standings.
Yeah,
they might punt. I don't know. Again, we have a very conservative majority who's been skeptical of a lot of President Biden's programs. That might happen again.
Interesting. That is David Cohen, a professor of law at Drexel University. Thank you so much for joining us, David. Boy, we covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time. Thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, trivia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, folks, we are back. The final segment of the week on Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry.
Yes, Avi.
Should we do some trivia?
Are you ready?
We're being told we have to.
Game show voice. I'm looking forward to hearing that. And our contestant is standing by in studio. We have Nick from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nick, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm going to warm you up. Are you a dog, cat, or other person?
I'm a cat person.
Yes.
Oh, meow.
Yes, I'm a cat person too. So I'm really rooting for you now, Nick.
I appreciate that, Avi.
And you get a chance now to win some swag, some Studio 2 swag. You can look at the mug right in front of you. That's what
pretty
the swag
nice.
Looks like.
It's a fetching mug. I would love to
with
wear
with that orange
it's
interior.
A fetching mug.
It's that orange interior gets yes. you every time.
So imagine yourself drinking a hot beverage out of that to inspire you as you receive this question, okay? So in 1919, Nick, the Supreme Court issued a famous ruling in a free speech case that stemmed from Philadelphia, actually. It's a famous case in part because Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote in the opinion, quote, "The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man falsely shouting fire in a blank and causing a panic." What word goes in the blank? Now, I can give you choices if you want, but it sounds like you're ready to just take it.
I believe the answer is theater.
Oh, my goodness.
Theater for the winner, chicken dinner.
Nick is the first person who didn't even want choices. Nick, you are the greatest Studio 2 trivia champion of all time. Congratulations.
That's very kind. I'm sure my college media law professor would be ashamed if I got that wrong.
Is Nick a ringer? I don't know. It's a little too good.
And you just leaned all the way in and didn't even like blink. And just said the answer.
So cool under pressure. Nick, I will point out that a lot of people think it's crowded theater. It is not crowded theater. That's not what was wrote. Also, a lot of people forget the fact that he said falsely shouting fire in the theater. The case stems out of Philly, and it was the case was surrounding a socialist in Philadelphia who was distributing anti-war literature, which would be perfectly legal now, but under First Amendment interpretation at the time was considered illegal. So did you learn something at least there, Nick?
I could lie and say yes.
How do you know all this, Nick?
I work in media, and I loved media law in college.
Oh, my
gosh. Yay. Well, you know what? We're so glad that you know your stuff.
God,
really
I thought
are.
I was so smart. And Nick was like,
so
yeah,
we
gotta no,
give Nick
obvious.
We got to give the mug and the grocery tote.
Absolutely. Nick earned
I definitely
all
need
it.
More tote bags for sure.
Two tote bags for Nick.
I
just
know. You
it.
Can give away one. There you go.
Nick, thanks so much for joining us. And I guess we'll have to try to have you back on Studio 2 Trivia at some point to see if we really can stump you.
That would be my pleasure, and it was really lovely to be here with you both.
Thanks,
thank
Nick.
You so much, Nick. And July 4th is right around the corner, and there's a ton to do in our region, from fireworks to winery tours to concerts and some big, big musical artists performing on the Parkway. Tanya Pendleton has rounded up the best things to do.
If you were smart enough to plan ahead and take the time off, your weekend extends to 5 days with 4th of July hitting on Tuesday this year. We applaud your foresight. But as we come to the end of Black Music Month and Pride Month, we know that the promise of the holiday wasn't initially extended to everyone. As we celebrate the nation's independence and its attempts to achieve a more perfect union, let's try to remember the things that bring us together, not the things that keep us apart. Fireworks. Now they bring people together. And if the weather cooperates, you can see them in several places over the next few days. On Saturday, the U.S. Army's Pershing Zone concert takes place at Penn's Landing. The concert starts at 8, followed by fireworks at 9:30. And it's all free, part of the Welcome America celebration. On Sunday, there's a party on the pier at Rivers Casino, which includes food trucks, free swag, and music by the ultimate king of pop, a Michael Jackson tribute band. That party kicks off at 6 p.m. And on Tuesday, you know where everyone's gathering, on the Parkway, for the big concert and fireworks with Ludacris and Demi Lovato. Festivities start at 7 p.m. We'll have details about more 4th of July celebrations in the Delaware Valley on our website, whyy.org/things to do. Chadsford Winery is hosting a red, white, and barbecue event on Saturday and Sunday. Admission is free, but you can step up to a VIP ticket that comes with perks like early entry and a premium tasting. They're premiering their new sparkling apple wine, and if you're one of the first 100 guests through the doors, you'll get a free tasting. In the spirit of the holiday, they're also offering the Firecracker Wine Slushy and the Patriotic Punch. Things get started at noon on both days. Back in the city, Pride Month is being celebrated at the Weitzman Museum. They're hosting an album release party for Rena Branson's Love is the Ground that is also Queer Jewish Music Night.
I will carry you through these changes. I will carry you through these changes.
The concert is tonight starting at 7:30 and is both in person and on Zoom. There's a sliding fee scale for each. Big girls do cry, but Frankie Valli has been soothing those tears for over 60 years. The crooner and the latest incarnation of the Four Seasons are at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City on Saturday at 7 p.m. If you're spending the long weekend down the shore, go check out A Living Legend. If their work ethic is any indication, both Chill Moody and Low-Cut Connie's Adam Wiener are on their way to legend status as well. The homegrown talents are combining forces for a show at the Man tonight.
I'm feeling away, I'm feeling away, I'm feeling away right now. You was running wild, down for the cloud, hating for the crowd. Hating was in style, hating's not allowed. Looked inside yourself, hated what you found. Saw the price of fame, hated the amount. Time is money and a clock ticking. Plot thickens, really going from the block spitting to our own stock ticker. Hold up, had some tears in it.
They'll be joined by two visual artists as well to celebrate 50 years of hip hop. This is the first concert in the Downstage series curated by Chill, who's the venue's first community artist in residence. The show starts at 8 p.m.
Look who's dancing. Look who's dancing. Look who's dancing now.
Look who's dancing. It's you, because you're at the Freeman Arts Pavilion in Delaware on Friday night to see Ziggy Marley. The reggae star will be in town with his own brand of feel-good music inspired by his father, the legendary Robert Nesta Marley, who taught him to embrace the light. Ja Rastafari. The show starts at 7. We're dancing out of here, but we'll be back next Thursday with more things to do. I'm Tanya Pendleton, and we wish you a very happy 4th of July. Be safe out there, people. If you want details about what you've heard and to find out more events, including where the Philly Vegan Awards is happening and why July is a good time to eat out in Monco, head to our website, whyy.org/things to do. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
Little reggae there for you. We're rocking. It feels really good. I'm really looking forward to 4th of July this year. I'm having a cookout.
And we're all invited, right? Yeah, me and all the listeners.
Yeah, we're going to have ribs. Smoked
ribs. You heard that, folks. We're all just invited to Cherry Gregg's house this weekend. Or next week.
But not
Tuesday.
Really. True, but not really. But yeah. But we'll have a
you'll
we'll
all be
celebrate
there in
the
spirit. Yeah.
Exactly. For sure.
That's it for our show today. You're saying mercifully. We welcome you back next week on Wednesday, the day after the 4th, for another hour of Studio
Yay.
2. Our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, Andreas Copes, Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Those folks are the best. Mm-hmm. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg, wishing you a wonderful weekend and a happy Independence Day. Thanks for joining us.